Well, this is Dennis Emery, and I'm here with Jack Diddy. And Jack, I think it's fair to say that you're Mr. Tennis in Ashland, Kentucky, and Eastern Kentucky of the modern era. How did you get started playing tennis in that Ashland area?
Well, Dennis, I'm first of all very happy to do this with you, and I don't know that I'm the Mr. Tennis, but I've tried to support tennis in every way that I can for many years, and I've been involved with tennis since I was 9 years old. But I was lucky enough to, my dad's friend, Sam Mansbach, had an estate that had a private tennis court and a swimming pool, and it's where we always went swimming. And when I was about nine, I would watch Sam Mansbach and his friends, Don Dooley and Mike and Bill Metzler and Frank Fisher, all of them play tennis on that court. And Jay Hanna, who was my age, we'd sit there on the diving board of the pool and watch these men play tennis. So Jay and I started playing at nine. And when they'd hit a ball over the fence in the woods or the weeds there, or whatever, we'd chase it down. And after they'd all left, we'd take it out on the court and try to hit back and forth. So that was how I got started. And we had a great time, just the two of us playing. And then we started following things in the news, and we read about Pancho Gonzalez, and we read about Rod Laver and Ken Rosewall, and we'd pretend that we were those players, and we'd play sets back and forth, although we weren't actually calling the score correctly. It was very confusing when I first started, when they have, say, you know, the point might be 35 instead of 30-15. Right. You know, I thought there was an extra point. For years, I liked that extra right. point. So instead of 15, 30, 40, I'd say 5, 15, 30, 40. And finally, one of the guys in the high school team, when I joined the high school team in eighth grade, corrected me. And so I went for several years not even knowing how to keep score right. We didn't really have any teachers or coaches at that time. There were not many players in Ashland. There were five tennis courts down at Central Park, and they were directed by Professor R.W. Ross. And Professor Ross was a teacher in Booker T. Washington School, which was our local segregated black school. But when it closed in 1954, he lost his job as a teacher there. But he had been taking care of Central Park tennis courts for many years before that. I think 1937 is when he started. He was hired by Ernie Chatton, who was the director of the YMCA. So Professor Ross ran a really excellent program at the Central Park courts. He was very strict. He kept it very well organized. He had a sheet there that you wrote your name down at the hour that you wanted to play. And when that, at the end of every hour, he would say that to everybody there. Everybody could hear him. He had a sort of a booming voice, and he'd say, "End of the 4 o'clock hour." And that meant anybody on the list there at 5 o'clock could walk immediately on the court. And everybody that was on the court had to stop right where they were, and didn't matter whether in the middle of a match or playing set point, they put down their racket and walked off the court. I never saw an argument once over that.
That's great.
Everybody respected his discipline, but he never raised his voice really. He was just an authoritative figure we all looked up to. I didn't know it at the time, but years and years later, I'm talking about 40 years later, when I looked into his past history, trying to honor him, I found out he had been a first lieutenant in the U.S. Army in France in World War I. Well, I didn't know it at the time, but he conducted our sessions down there with sort of military discipline. And he would, when people walked up for the first time ever, You went over and introduced yourself to Professor Ross, told him who you were and stuff, and then he would tell you the kind of the rules. These are the rules. It was definitely his place, and he would teach you how to keep score if you didn't know it, and he would give you the basic rudiments of the game. And he had a little peach basket with these little tennis balls that were so worn down it looked like little gray mice. They were so tiny, but anyway. He would take you out on the court, and he would show you all the lines, show you the boundaries, tell you how it was in or out, give you the rules of courtesy, which were extremely important to him, that you, you know, introduce yourself to start with to your opponents, and that you keep score correctly, and change sides. And he did all those things that you, that a player needs to know, and capsulized in just a few moments. And he did this with anybody that showed up new at the tennis course. So everybody knew when they came down there, how to play the game, how to be courteous, how to give other people respect. You didn't run across the court, for instance, when a match was in play. I mean, a point was in play. You waited till the point was over. And then if you weren't obstructing anything, then you could run across that court to the other court. And I remember all those things just like they were just right this minute. And I was 13 the first time I ever walked on Central Park courts. And he had offered a city championship with a 14 and under division. And I went down there and signed up for it. And at the time, the you had to like find your opponent and then find a time to play and then play your match and then tell Professor Ross the match. And then he would sign that in on the tournament sheet. And the tournament took place starting in the summer, and it would end in August sometime. And it, the draw, you know. And so I found my, you know, I found the name of my opponent, but turned out he had gone to some camp somewhere. He was gone for about 2 months. I called him week after week trying to find a way to play. And I would go to Professor Ross and I'd say, look, Ricky can't, he's not back. He's not going to be in town for weeks. Can I just have a default? And so I could go on and play the next match. He said, no, Mr. Diddy, the rules are everybody has to schedule their match. He would not let me default this guy. Finally, this guy got back about the week he was ready to close the tournament. And so I called Ricky, the guy who was going to play, Rick Stump. I called the other guys on the draw who had already advanced down the row. And I called them all and I said, okay, be here Saturday morning. We're going to play this out and finish it. So I went down and I played four matches in a row and I won the 14 and under singles. It was the first trophy I ever won for anything. And prior to that time, at that time I was pretty small. I was about the size of a fourth grader today. And I was 13. I was playing baseball and Babe Ruth baseball. And the guys in Babe Ruth were 13 to 15. And we had guys that were grown men that were 15. And I decided I need to stick with tennis. And I had played junior league football. And I could see that was not going to be my future. The football pants came down to my ankles. And then basketball, I was the last guy on the third team of our seventh grade basketball team. And I scored 2 points the whole season. So by default, I figured tennis, I better stick with tennis. And right. I weighed 75 pounds in the seventh grade at that point. And so winning that tournament was a big deal to me. I still have the little trophy downstairs. And when we had the city champions all met for a picture, and I met George Rupert. And you've met George because you've done interviews with him for the archive right. for UK. And I met George there with the picture, and he was the men's city champion. He was 24, and he had just finished playing varsity tennis for UK, and he was about 6'5". So he was an awesome figure, and he was a very good player. And before I met him there, he just kind of took me under his wing. He would ask me to hit with him and stuff like that. And of course, I was just a beginner, but this was big for me. And then that next summer, when I was 14, he offered a tournament, and I won the division in the tournament to advance out of that. And so did Bill Beverly and Bill Simpson and Jay Hanna. And so he took us the next week to Murray, Kentucky for the JC. It was a JC tournament, and this was the JC state tournament then. And then we would have played in that, but I was in the open division, the 16s, and nobody else entered the open. They all entered the novice division. So I won by default. I didn't play a match, and they gave me the championship. So then Bill Beverly and Bill Simpson play. They won their divisions in the open and the novice. And so then George said, okay, I'm going to take you to Provo, Utah to play in the national JC championships at Brigham Young University. And he did. He took us cross country with his wife, Helen, and had Bill Beverly and Bill Simpson, number one and two players on the high school team that were seniors. And then Tom Rupert, his brother, and me, and I was 14. So I was sort of the junior player of the trip, and they would play stunts on me at night and stuff like that. I mean, it was really good though. I got to then hit and play with Bill Beverly and Bill Simpson, who were 5 years older than I was, and they were the best local players. And Bill Beverly went on a scholarship to Western Kentucky University, and he roomed with Jackie Cooper. And I met Jackie Cooper that summer. Jackie Cooper and Mickey Shad came to Ashland and did an exhibition right after they had won the National Doubles Championship for 18 and under guys. And they were the number one ranked team in the country in USTA doubles. And I got to play. They played Bill Beverly and Bill Simpson, and they let me play a few games. And I remember Mickey Shad with his serve. He had a great, you know, spin serve and everything. He showed me how to hit his serve. And he also gave me a really good tip. He said, take all that change you have in your pocket out of your pocket before you go hit on the court. I had all this change jangling around while I was trying to hit with it, you know. So did this
experience with George Rupert, is that what led you to the University of Kentucky and on the team there?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yes. George Rupert, later on, on this trip to Provo, Utah and back, we ended up spending 3 weeks going out there. And after we had played all week, we all lost 6-0, 6-0. I didn't win a game, singles or doubles. But George was, we had a great time. And George said, you know, we're only about this far from Los Angeles. So instead of going home, we're going to drive to Los Angeles. So we spent two more weeks driving to Los Angeles and going through Palm Springs and Las Vegas at 4 o'clock in the morning and the Golden Horseshoe Casino. And I just had all kinds of adventures for a 14-year-old kid. This was just a huge eye opener that there's a whole big country out there. And I would sit in the car thinking about it. And I would think, gosh, you know, with this tennis racket, I could go anywhere. I could go anywhere in the world. You could drop me anywhere in the world. And with tennis skills, I could meet people. I could stay at their house. I could teach their kids. And I would have food on the table. I mean, I realized what the value of that was at 14. And I resolved right then to get a tennis scholarship, just like George had to UK, Bill Beverly to Western. Bill Simpson played on the freshman team at UK. I was writing my goals down all the time up to that point. And the reason I was writing goals, my dad had a severe jet plane crash. He was a Marine Corps jet fighter pilot. And he crashed in Memphis, Tennessee when I was 8 years old and broke his neck and back. And he was confined there in the hospital from May until Christmas Day. And I only saw him one day because they thought he was going to die at one point in August. And they flew me down to get to see him. But he survived, but he was not really physically capable of playing sports. And he had been very athletic. He was a good baseball player for the Ashland Tomcats, and he got through pre-flight school, which is all kinds of athletic competitions. And he was in good shape and all that. And to have him just be completely broken down with a broken neck and back and in bed on traction every day and not able to go to work most of the time, it was really tough. And so much I wanted to be able to hit tennis with my dad or throw baseball with my dad or play golf with him or do something like the other kids, but he couldn't. So we had long talks in every single night. I mean, we talked for an hour or more every single night I was growing up. And he would tell me about what it took to get through pre-flight school during World War II. You know, they would have a class of people that were applying to get into flight school. And there might be 250 guys in this class. And out of that, they might take 10 or 15 or something. But to get through that, they had to do all kinds of competitions. They also took classes. They had to do well in the classes and all kinds of like gunnery and different things and physics of different types and aeronautics. And then they had to get up in the morning, early in the morning. They got like 5 o'clock in the morning and they did calisthenics and stuff. And then they ran, you know, long distance and they lifted weights. They did all that stuff. And then they played, they did wrestling. They did boxing. They played basketball. They played soccer. They played football. They did war ball. They did all these things. And my dad would tell me about all these different things he did and how they played them. And, you know, like in basketball, they played with absolutely no rules. The only rule was you had to get the ball in the goal. Well, if somebody had the ball, they didn't worry about where they walked. They would tackle them and take the ball away from them. That was okay, because what they were teaching them was they had one goal, and that was it, and they had to make it. And if they didn't, they lost. You know, and what they were teaching these guys, these were all 18, 19 year old guys, is, you know, they were, these guys were going to be fighter pilots in a few weeks and months. They were going to be trained in planes where they were going to be up in the air and fighting either the Germans or the Japanese in dogfights, who are there, that guy's trying to kill you. It doesn't matter whether the guy walked in basketball. That guy's going to do everything he can to kill you with his airplane, you know? And I tell you, as an 8, 9, and 10-year-old kid, my dad was teaching me the rules and teaching me games of life. You know, he wanted me to be a survivor. He was a survivor. It was incredible. He survived the crash. He and the co-pilot both survived crashing from, you know, 600 feet when the plane, the jet engine failed, and they had to find a landing spot and spot it, and so it didn't crash into a building or something in Memphis, Tennessee. And they found a plot where they could land, and they did it at a level that kind of went down a little bit, incline went down, and they clipped a tree with the wing, and the jet fuel started spraying out of the wing, and they knew it was going to catch on fire. They had to get out of the cockpit with broken necks and back, both of them, and climb down on the wing and crawl away from the plane before it exploded, which it did. And they were survivors, but they had been through the training to do this. And he had such a willpower that was such an incredible power to survive that most people would not have even lived through the crash and the aftermath and being in a cast for 6 months from the head to the groin and then recovery from this huge wound in his back from laying in that cast that all the way to his backbone. And he lived for 50 years after that.
Oh my gosh.
And I tell you what, my dad was a hero. He was a hero bigger than life. Every day I got to talk with my hero. And this is the driving force that I have that's been instilled in me since I was in grade school, where I write down what I want to accomplish, and I write it down and I keep track of it and I go back and analyze it. At the end of the year, I go back and write down look at all the goals I've written from the years before. And then I look at them again, and then I write out my new goals for next year. I've been doing this ever since I was about 11 or 12 years old. And I would get up in the mornings before school and run laps around our block, which was a half mile. And as I got better at doing that, it didn't seem like such a big deal. Then I would run up Floyd Street, ran up the steepest hill in Ashland to the water tower, and then turn around and run back. And I would do all that. And I'd do push-ups and sit-ups all before school started. I did it every day. I did it winter and summer. In the winter, Jimmy Fannin and I went, once we got Jimmy Fannin started playing in the eighth and ninth grade, we'd get up early in the morning, go down to Central Park and sweep snow off the court to be able to play in December and January. And so, this enabled me, this drive enabled me to pick up tennis as a sport, to focus on it, to focus at that point at age 14 to get a tennis scholarship to college. And by the time I got to be 18, George introduced me to Dick Vemont and Jim Fannin. And we also got scholarship offers at Marshall and East Tennessee State. And we decided to, Jimmy went to East Tennessee and he did really well and has had an incredibly successful life. He played on the world-class tennis tour and then he coached the top 10 players in the world. And Peter Fleming was one of his main guys, John McEnroe's doubles partner. And, started a professional club in Chicago and did great. And he's coached over 2,600 athletes, professional athletes in 8 different sports, the very top people in the world. And so he's made a whole life out of doing all this. I didn't make a life out of motivational speaking and things like that, but I wanted to go to medical school. So my written goals were to go to medical school. And it's because of my dad. I wanted to be able to help people like I wanted to help my dad, but I couldn't. There was nothing I could do for him medically. But I had great role models in medicine, like Dr. Malcolm King, who took care of my dad for 50 years. And not to say less about my mom. I mean, my mom was a big factor in my life, but she was more of a quiet, supporting actor. I mean, in the sense that she had been an excellent student. She made 4.0s, and she went to college and graduated from Denison University and in chemistry, and she was Phi Beta Kappa and stuff like that. And she encouraged me to read. Everything that I did in working in physical type activities with my dad's encouragement, I was doing with my mom in academics. And so I had two really supportive people who had accomplished in their own arenas, and they were giving me the support to do things to help me be better. And I was constantly trying to be better in anything that I did. And I study as hard and just as intensely. Today, I'm studying Russian. I've been studying Russian since 1989. And I studied Russian for a couple of hours today. I study hours every day on subjects that are interesting to me that I want to know. And I take courses all the time. So although I emphasize tennis for young kids and I promote tennis and I want them to do well in tennis, it's not at the expense of academics. It should be coincidental with academics. It should be a program that they write down their goals to do well in tennis and to be stronger and more fit and be able to hit more forehands and backhands and serve a higher percentage and hopefully win more matches. But on the same time, they should be striving to be the very best students they can and to be as accomplished as possible and to go as far in their education as they can. And so
let me just interject here for a second.
Okay.
Because I think that's a good segue into your daughter, Julie, who, you know, I know she told me at one point, my dad has me write down my goals every year. And, you know, so I can see where, you know, that you carried that over to your children. And the education part, Julie ended up going to Vanderbilt. But let's talk a little bit about Julie, because she became number one in the country, number one in the United States. And she did that from Ashland, Kentucky, which a lot of people say you can't get there from here. How were you able to get her to number one in the country and then a scholarship at Vanderbilt? And then after you address that, we'll talk about her pro career.
Well, everything I just said that my dad was doing with me, I did with my kids. I talked with my kids all the time, and it was a planned thing. I mean, I met Juanita on a blind date. Tommy Wade, who was our number one player on the team, the UK team, and I had a great team at UK. Those guys were all terrific and all influenced me greatly. But Steve Imhoff he was my doubles partner. We've already played twice in the last 2 months. We're still here. We are 73 years old. He's 74, and we're still playing. And my roommate Tom Dembo played with him last month. So I met Juanita, and we had a blind date to play tennis at Woodland Park. And from that, 3 years later, we got married, and then I started medical school at the University of Louisville. And I got jobs teaching tennis at Harmony Landing Country Club and Big Springs Country Club. And that was a great boost to help with tennis and things. But I taught Juanita how to play. And I spent years teaching her how to play. Maybe 8 or 10 years I spent really focusing on developing her game. And she did really well. And we set out to start with to have six children. We wanted to have six children before we were 35. Those are my written goals. And she had one miscarriage before Kramer was born, but we had Amy when I was a junior in med school, at Jay when I was an intern at Grady Hospital in Emory in Atlanta. And then we had Jenny in Atlanta and Julie in Atlanta. She was born about a year before we left Atlanta. And then Christy, when we moved to Ashland, and Kramer was born in 1983. And we were 35 at that point. So we quit. But I had had a cousin that had Down syndrome, and they warned against people having pregnancies after 35. The incidence that went way up. So I was just used that as a guideline that we wanted to try and have our family as young as we could. And then we would train the kids in all these different areas. So one thing I used as a training manual was the West Point Fitness and Diet book. It was a little paperback book, and it told about the fitness programs that they use at West Point and the Annapolis and the Air Force Academy. And all of the cadets have to learn 36 different sports. And by that, they have to take a class in every sport. I mean, they take classes in like billiards and ping pong But they do it in like wrestling and boxing and orienteering, mountain climbing. And, you know, they have all kinds of things that they include in that. But they have all the most common sports that you can think of are listed in those 36 sports. And I thought, well, I won't do all the military things they do, but we'll do 25 of those sports. So we did 25 of those sports that I tried to teach the kids skills. And we would practice basketball and football and baseball and all that stuff. And then I got them into teams as they were growing up on all those different areas. We also got them into dance. They were taking, 16 dance classes a week, I think it was. And then we did hiking and mountain climbing and bicycling and, all that stuff. And so our kids grew up with all these different skills and they played all these different sports and they'd still do a lot today. Kramer ended up being on the crew team. You know, he was in rowing. I went to watch him do a rowing competition in Charleston, West Virginia when he was in college and met Governor Manchin. He was Governor Manchin at that time. We were doing all these different sports. And when we didn't have those sports like soccer, then I created them. I created a soccer league at their school, Bellefonte Youth Soccer Association. We had 300 kids that ended up joining the league. And then we had to change the name to the Greenup County Youth Soccer Association because so many kids from all over the county played. We had hundreds of kids that played in that and organized all their teams and everything, coached a lot of their teams. And then they played. I formed a girls' competitive team that played all kinds of sports. They played in the Ashland City Softball League and they played in multiple basketball leagues and they ran 5K runs and we formed a 10K on July 4th every year, 1985. And that race went on. I did it for 6 years and then it went on for the next 35 years. But all of our kids ran in the 10K, even Julie. And actually for Julie to run it, she was sick in the hospital. And when she was seven and Dr. Robinson was her doctor, said she couldn't leave the hospital. She still had to stay in for more IVs because of whatever she had at that point. And Julie signed herself out of the hospital at age seven and said, I'm going to run the 10K anyway. And she did.
Yeah.
And I didn't encourage it. And I didn't run with her or anything. I thought, well, you know, she'll just run a few blocks and then, you know, she'll realize this is too long and she'll quit. She won't hurt herself or anything. You know, she ran that whole thing at 6.2 miles at 7 years old with nobody with her out on the city streets. It was actually, see, the thing was many times I would put them out on the edge of things that were like beyond what I thought really they should be doing. And I had a lot of second thoughts, like we would be hiking places that were really somewhat treacherous, things like that, which I wouldn't do again if I had to do it over again.
Knowing what you know now.
Yeah. I mean, after I finished, you know, like, oh my God, couldn't believe it. We'd done that, you know?
How would you describe Julie's game?
Julie was an all court player. She grew up on so many different surfaces, you know, like, and one thing let me just say before you talk any more about Julie, I wanted Julie to learn from lots of coaches from the time she was real early. I could see Julie had talent. Most people who saw her when she was real little, she started hitting when she was three and they'd see her hitting, you know, ball after ball and they go, gosh, you know, she's going to go somewhere. Well, I felt like very, not worthy of being her coach. I wanted to be her dad and I was going to help her in any way I could, but I wanted real coaches to help her. And just to give you an idea, I have a paper I put together for her in 1995 that I found in looking up this talk. And let me see, where's that paper about the coaches? Anyway, this is a list of like all the tournaments she'd played at that point and all the national championships and everything and all of her rankings and titles and all this stuff. I thought this included all the coaches. But anyway, she had about 30 coaches before she got to you. You know, when you invited her to come to UK, she was ranked like 50th in the 12s as a 12-year-old. No, 50th in the 14s, national 14s as a 12-year-old. And you were nice enough to invite her to come to Lexington, and she did. And she spent 2 years there in Lexington with you at UK. And Of course, Marianne Simmons was the coach of the Lexington Christian Academy thing, and Melissa Eplin was her coach in the Russell High School team. But in addition to that, she had like Todd Wise that was working with her, and she had also had a week that Stan Smith invited her over to his house in Hilton Head, and he coached her for a week at his house. And then we ran into Billie Jean King on the beach while we were there, and she wanted to hit with her, and she came over and hit with her at 7 o'clock in the morning and taught her one-handed backhand volley and stuff like that. But there were at least 30 different coaches. And of course, Carlos Drada worked with her, and Rich Benson and Susan Sloan and Dwayne Lundy. And the guys here in Ashland, Eddie Sizemore, BJ Lahozet, and gosh, there were so many people that worked with her. So she's the product of many, many people, not just me by any means. I just wanted her to have a chance to get exposure from like really good coaches so that she could go further in her life. And she did, you know, she took advantage of all those opportunities. And the USTA also gave her opportunities going to the USTA camps. They started inviting her to that when she was about 13. And those were terrific with Carol Watson and all the coaches of the USTA. So when she came to train with you, she was very focused at that point. She had been writing her goals down for years since she was in the first grade. And it was very obvious from the first grade, she just wrote down, play tennis 1 hour a day, you know. No, I think it didn't even say that. It said play tennis. And then right. The second grade, she wrote down, play tennis 1 hour a day. And then she started writing down, like, beat mom and dad, beat her older sisters and brother, and, you know. And then make the high school team. And she went out for the high school team then in the second grade on her own, not because we encouraged her to, but Amy and Jenny were already playing on the high school team, and they were in the fourth grade and sixth grade by that point. So, the coach was already tuned into them. And then Carol Watson was coaching. Carol Fannin, was the coach, and she, said that she could play and, let her be on the team. And she worked her way up to number two at that point. And so she played number two on the Russell High School team the rest of the time until Amy graduated, who was number one. And her, you know, she just kept doing really well. But she had losses. You know, I was telling you, I found a thing here. I compiled all of her USTA matches from when she was 12 to when she was 16. And she had won 311 USTA tournament matches, but she had lost 64 matches. And it was 83% that had worked out that way. And so it wasn't like she was the dominating player in anything. You know, she wasn't the best 12-year-old necessarily. She was ranked number one in the 14s as a 14-year-old, but she could lose to those players, and she never actually won the national singles 14 championship. Because she got to the finals of those and did well and beat all the other players, her ranking ended up being number one, but it wasn't like she dominated that somehow. And then she was ranked number two in the 16s and number seven in the 18s. But she kept doing well in the national junior circuit, and a lot of her tennis players that she was playing with, they were almost all still there at 14. But after 14, some of them started going out on the pro tour, and like Megan Shaughnessy. She didn't play more juniors after that. Megan Shaughnessy played professionally after that and got ranked. And Marissa Urban, who was in the juniors with Julie, although she played at Stanford, went on the pro tour as a freshman. And they did well. They did very well. And a lot of people encouraged us to put Julie on the pro tour, have her play pro tournaments as a junior, but we were really aiming at a tennis scholarship. We wanted her to be able to have a college degree like her brothers and sisters. And our daughter Amy was playing college tennis for Furman University with Debbie Southern and having a great experience playing college tennis. And I enjoyed playing college tennis. And I was really hoping that Julie would play college tennis instead of going on the pro tour when she finished the juniors. And she did. And so she had visits at like Tennessee, UK, Florida, Georgia, and Vanderbilt. And she, Florida and Georgia were number one and two at that time. And she liked the coaches and she liked the schools and she liked, she knew all the players at those schools, but they had tons of All-Americans. And she came from back from those two trips and said, you know, if I go to either one of those schools, even if I am the best I can be on the team, and even if I am an All-American, they've already got some All-Americans. I'll just be another All-American. But Vanderbilt doesn't have any. And they didn't. They didn't have any trophies. They didn't have any banners. They didn't have anybody been ranked very high in nationals. And they were number 15 in the country. And she liked Jeff McDonald. And so she decided to go to Vanderbilt. Now, UK, I was hoping she'd go to UK, really. But at that time, UK was under a big transition at that time of their coaches. They had just turned over the coaches right at that point when she started visiting. And so they had a new coach who was a really nice guy, but he didn't really have any record with the team yet. He hadn't even coached any matches there yet. So it was just too much of an unknown when I thought Julie should have somebody that had some kind of past record. And Jeff had a really good record at being the coach at LSU and being at Duke. And I had met him years before when Julie was in eighth grade. So I had been speaking with him for several years before Julie even knew about it.
What would you say was your best memory of Julie's Vanderbilt years?
Well, I guess really the national championships. I mean, we enjoyed all of them, and we went to so many of the matches. We went to the home matches and a lot of the away matches. And every year I took a week off work and went to the national indoor championships and spent 1 week with all the girls in the team when nobody else was there. I mean, there were like maybe four other parents maybe that would go to the national indoors. And I spent all week with them in Madison, Wisconsin, where they have the national indoors. And I knew a lot of the players on the other teams and the other coaches and all that kind of stuff. And there was no crowds at all. I mean, there might be a big crowd at any match in the national indoors would be 10 people, you know? And,
did Vanderbilt win the national indoors or?
No, they did real well. They didn't actually win the national indoors. No, but they were doing better every year. They improved every year Julie was there. They had to work their way up, and they got better players each year as they were recruiting and they were doing better in the nationals. They also were recruiting better players. Kate Burson went there who the next year after Julie, who was from Nashville, and Jeff had coached her all the years. She was a junior, and she was very good. And Jenny Miller was a top ranked national player from Georgia, and they were real good friends, Aunt Julie and Jenny.
Risk.
And Sarah Risk came. See, she came. She was a top national player. Sarah Risk was like really good. She's really tall. And Julian and Sarah played great doubles, but Jeff split them up for the nationals. I was hoping they'd play together, but he split them up, and she played with the Leaky Sabanas, who is now the varsity coach now. And but Aliki was a good doubles player. And then Blumberg played, and Ann Plessinger, they were all on the team. And so anyway, they had a solid team, and they did really well in the nationals, and they won their each round, just round by round, just by barely, you know, beating Georgia. You know, it was a tough match and everything. They got past the other tough teams, and then they got to the finals and played Stanford in the final match.
This is Julie's senior year.
Her senior year, yes. And so she was playing the girl that had the best record. She, as a matter of fact, she at the national indoors, I can't think of her name right now, but she had the best winning record of any player in the history of women's college tennis. The most consecutive wins without a loss. And the match that set the win was the day that she beat Julie in the national indoors. Uh-huh. And then the very next match, she lost.
Oh gosh.
So if you look up the most college wins in women's tennis, you'll see her name, that girl's name. And and the win is over Julie Diddy. But I thought, gosh, Julie, I just thought she was so wound up and so tense. Her opponent was so tense for that match. She was so nervous. I knew if Julie could just come out and win the first game, put some pressure on her, she was gonna collapse. Well, that's what happened the match after she played. After she played, she just collapsed on the court. It was just too much mental pressure to keep it up. And she was like glad to have it over with. It was done.
But, so the national championship match, Vandy loses to Stanford, who's in the middle of probably another championship.
Yes.
Consecutive championship run. So any other memories other than that? Because that's, I guess Julie played the singles and doubles after that, but
yes.
But so you would, for you, the highlight of Julie's college career would have been playing then that national championship match against Vanderbilt.
Yeah. Vanderbilt playing Stanford.
I mean, playing against Stanford.
Yeah. No, that was absolutely the highlight. I mean, and for one, that was for Julie. Julie was a team player. She loved to play for the team. I mean, she would go all out in matches. And that's why her doubles records are so much different, lopsided, versus her singles. She really relaxed playing with the doubles player, whereas with the singles, she was extremely uptight and didn't have a way to relax well. And so she would get real wound up in matches in singles. But in doubles, she was like laughing and playing and giggling and I mean, it was really fun to watch her play doubles because the two players had such a great time. And she did this with anybody that she played with. And I think it goes all the way back to playing with her sister, Jenny. You know, when Julie went out for the high school team, her partner was Jenny. Well, Julie was in the second grade and Jenny was in the fourth grade. And they were playing high school players every match. And they would just laugh and carry on and giggle and do all the stuff little kids do. And at the end of the match, they'd go shake hands with these two kids who were like sophomores or juniors or seniors in high school who weren't very happy. Okay. It was a big contrast. And I can tell you, the parents were not happy. Okay. It wasn't enjoyable for anybody except Julie and Jenny. And they just had their own little world and they played together for 5 years as doubles partners. And they played USDA tournaments. They played the state high school. They won 5 regional doubles titles. They generally beat seniors each year after year. So in the third grade, she was beating seniors to win the regional and then go down and play in the state tournament. And the comment the girls made when they played in the state high school tournament, they lost in the first round of that first time they went when Julie was in third grade. And the TV guy came and filmed it. And he asked the two girls, "How'd you like playing these two little junior players?" And they said, "Well, these are like kids we babysit for." But I think that playing with her sister relaxed Julie so much, and she took on anybody she ever played with, including in college and in professionally. She had such a terrific record. She won 30 professional titles in doubles, and she did it with all kinds of different partners. You know, it was amazing. She'd pick up somebody that was ranked 500 in the world, and then they'd go win the tournament.
Well, she's extraordinary. She actually is still the all-time leader on the U.S. pro circuit, you know, for singles and doubles titles. She's number one all time. And I know, you know, the double. Let's back up for a second.
Okay,
you know, sure. You're talking about her in the third grade. But she went on to win 3 state high school championships. You know, one of the few players to win 3. Now she didn't win them consecutively because she took time off to travel in Europe with the USTA. But what year was the first year she won the state high school?
Well, that's in 8th grade when she was playing for Lexington Christian Academy, and it was that was the year that she came down to work with you. You know, after working with you. After you'd been coaching Susan Sloan for like all those years and Susan retired and you called us and said, "Can Julie come down and work with her?" Well, that was amazing. And she improved so much in that year that she won the state high school championship. But she beat Jackie Trail, Julie was in 8th grade and Jackie Trail was in the 6th grade. But Susan Sloan won the whole thing when she was in the 6th grade. And several times. I think she won 3 more or something like that.
She won 6th, 7th, and 8th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. So that had already been done by a 6th grader before that. But but the eighth grade was when Julie won and beat Jackie. And then Jackie went on to be the number one ranked player in girls 18s in the United States.
Right.
And she turned pro at that point instead of going to college. And she turned down scholarships to every good school in the United States. And Julie didn't. We had sort of, we could kind of measure things with Jackie and see how Jackie was doing in the pros and Julie was doing in college. And then it was years later before Julie was played. Well, she did play the pro circuits after her sophomore year of college. The first year after college, she played the college summer circuit and she won every match and got to play in the U.S. Open as a result. But the next years, the 3 years after that, she played the USTA pro circuit, but they were in the summer. And then she'd go back and play in college. And it wasn't until she was 23 that she started playing on the pro circuit full time.
And that led her, as we said, to be the all-time winner on the pro circuits. And it led her to playing Fed Cup for the United States. Yeah. What, you know, as well as all the Grand Slams.
Yeah.
Several times. And, you know, I know you went with her to some of those Grand Slams. What's your best memory of her as a pro?
Well,
and I'm sure
I've got a lot. I've got a lot. I said before about this, going back and looking back over her record, those are like flashes of video for me. I'm sitting there on the sideline watching these matches, and I loved it all. I liked it when she was winning, but I liked it when she was losing. I enjoyed every bit of it. And then I guess going to watch Julie at Wimbledon to play the Williams sisters would be one of the main highlights. That happened she just was so lucky. They were doing the draw on Friday and she realized with her doubles ranking, and she found another girl there from like Czech Republic and her doubles ranking, that if they joined together right then and entered the doubles, that they might have a chance to get in the doubles draw. And they did. They were the last team to get in. I mean, it was talk about skin of their teeth. That was it. And so they got in the draw and she called me and she said, you know, we got in the doubles draw and everything. And so she had told me a year before that she was going to retire, from professional tennis the next year. And I realized this Wimbledon was her last Wimbledon for sure, because she was going to retire. And so I thought, I better go. Okay. So I bought a ticket and went to London. I got there on Monday and Julie played Venus and Serena in the first round.
And did they play on center court or did that?
They had it scheduled for center court and we waited several hours while there was a men's singles match going on at center court. Then they suddenly switched the court over to, I think it's court four. It's the one behind the stadium where all the ivy is behind on one wall.
Right.
Yeah. And they switched it because the men's double or singles match that was going on for so long. They were afraid they wouldn't be able to play it. Because they don't have lights, or they didn't at that time. So it was scheduled for a center court, and it was unfortunate she didn't get to play on center court. But they moved everything over there, and that venue only seated maybe 2,000 fans or something like that. But it was standing room only, see the match. And I got to sit in the friends box there, you know. And Julie's coach, who was with her at that time, Kevin O'Neill. And then Jeff McDonald was there. Her college coach, he was there covering Wimbledon for the New York Times. And then the guy on my right was a writer for the New York Times from Berlin, Germany. And so he wrote the New York Times European articles. And both of them ended up writing articles and included Julie in the articles and everything. But that was really thrilling to watch that match. And they were they did really well to start with. And they were up, 4-2, Julie serving, and Julie aced Venus and Serena back to back while she was serving. And then And then they were rushing the net, and they were doing a really good job of taking the net away from them. And that's what, why they were winning. And then Serena blasted a ball really right at Julie's head, and it just missed her. And it was hit so hard it hit the back drape in the air. And it was right at the net. All four of them were at the net when she hit that ball. And so the next point, Serena did the same thing to Julie's partner, and she hit her in the side, and the girl couldn't get out of the way of it and got hit in the side. And after the match, she had a big purple bruise on her abdomen where she got hit with that ball. And then the girl quit rushing the net, and the match completely turned on a dime. They lost 6-4, 6-2 then. But Julie had played Venus and Serena before, and she played them in world team tennis and things like that. So she wasn't really intimidated by them. But this was the first time that Julie had ever played with this partner. I can't remember her name now. She was a Czech Republic player, but, I got pictures of that, and I got videos of it, you know, and all that. And so that definitely was the highlight of her Grand Slam matches and everything.
So that's your best memory, but
yeah,
she also won the deciding match in Fed Cup.
Oh yeah,
you know, represent the United States in doubles.
Yes,
played with Lisa Huber.
Huber, right?
And you know what was it? Did you go to that?
No, that was in Surprise, Arizona, and you know Julie was asked to be on that team as a substitute for the girl that was injured, that was out, and she needed to have somebody to fill in, and she asked Vanya King and Julie to consider it, and then she would give them a call back. So we knew that Julie was going to get this call back, and she was just going to ask one or the other. And I talked with Julie about that, and I said, okay, when Mary Jo Fernandez calls you, make sure that you know, be cooperative. Whatever she says, you do it, okay? And so Julie said she told her that Mary Jo Fernandez asked her to play. She said, can you be there this next Monday? And Julie said, yes, I'll be there next Monday. I'll be proud to play for my nation, for my country, I think she said. And so Mary Jo had picked her for getting to play. But we didn't have any guarantee she would even play. The doubles match doesn't occur unless it goes to a 2-2 split.
Which so, it did.
Yeah, so it did go to a split, and then she did get to play. But we had, this all happened within a few days, and I didn't have time to, I didn't realize that this was going to be such an important thing for her. I wished I had. But so it came down to that final match, and I was watching it on TV, and the first point, they just blasted right at Julie, and she couldn't even begin to return it. The second point, I think she got a racket on it, but hit it in the net. And by the third point, she realized, hey, they're aiming at me. So Lisa went over to her and said, you know, just come on, let's go, you know, whatever. And Julie really respected Lisa a lot. And boy, she just shaped up and was ready for the next shot. And pretty soon she was back in the match. And it went back and forth, but they ended up winning the match. And Julie got to hit the winning shot to win the match. And Lisa came over and gave her a big hug. And that picture went around the world.
Yeah.
That was so cool. That was a huge day for Julie. And to get to play for the U.S. Fed Cup team, the national team, was a thrill. And she and Liesl became very good friends. Liesl was always giving her tips and advice and encouragement. And she got to, you know, practice with her different times, the US Open and stuff like that. And that was really nice.
Well, let's kind of circle back to your stuff.
Okay.
And you set up your practice in Ashland, like you said, very active in the clinics. But you also ran some tournaments there.
Yes.
And you decided, I'm sure, in large part because of watching Julie play all these challenger events, you decided to do a challenger event in Ashland, you know, which is a much smaller city than most of these challengers are playing.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And just kind of go into what your thoughts were on having this challenger in Ashland.
Okay. Well, I had run many tournaments before and lots of different events and things like that. So I was used to running events and tournaments, and we had the Kentucky State Hard Court that we started here, that went to Bowling Green, and the Kentucky State Open, which went to Owensboro. And so we had the experience of running those tournaments and city tournaments and things like that. And we did a lot of junior tournaments. So when Julie was playing in the professional league, I thought we started going to these pro circuit tournaments, and they were terrific, and I enjoyed them a lot. And I thought, well, we could do this, you know. And they had one in Louisville, and of course, the one you had in Lexington was great. And we'd go to that every year, and we loved it. And we were glad that Julie had a chance to come back and play in Kentucky. So the idea of having it here meant that she could possibly play on her home court. And so I worked hard to get that, you know, lined up here. And I had just had a couple of months before we did get it lined up. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and I had to have prostate surgery in June. And so I was still recovering from that. And at that point, I couldn't do much for a while. But the tournament was coming up in about another 6 or 8 weeks. And so we really had to scramble to put that together. It was a $25,000 tournament to start with. And we had a huge group of volunteers. We had 125 volunteers from the local community. Oh, we had all these people, all these sponsors, you know, we had lots of sponsors, probably 65 sponsors. And Julie's presence here, and people had been following her for so many years at that point, you know, through all the junior stuff and then the college, you know, with Vanderbilt and everything before she went on the pro tour. They wanted Julie to come back and play here, and everybody made it possible. I just happened to be in the position where I could help make it happen. And we did it, and we got it done, and it happened. And then the USDA wanted to boost it up. They were real pleased with it, and they made it a $50,000 the next year. So for the next 4 years, we had $50,000 tournaments here. And so we had five of them all together. And Julie played in all but one when she played in Southeast Asia, and she ended up playing Lindsay Davenport. When Lindsay Davenport had been off the tour having a baby, she came back to play in Bali, Indonesia. And she drew Julie in the first round. And that was a match that was kind of watched worldwide, because nobody knew whether Lindsay Davenport was really going to be able to come back from this and be a mom and play professional tennis. Well, she beat Julie, and she went on to win the tournament, and she beat the number three ranked player in the world to win the tournament. And then Julie played in China and Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou and all that, you know, and so she had a tremendous experience away from home for that week. And I would have loved to have had her here at that week. But we had terrific players, 56 international women professional players on the tour on the USTA Pro Circuit. And about half of them played in WTA events at any one time. And we had players like Agnes Savai, who was, after she left Asheville, she was 311 in the world when she got here. And she ended up being 18th in the world within 16 months of when she left Ashland. And she was from Hungary, and she just did an awesome job. She had some sort of injury and didn't continue at that level. Alexander Wozniak played here and beat Agnes Savai in the finals. It was a great match. And Alexander ended up in the top 30 in the world the next year. She was from Canada, and she was ranked about 300 in the world at the time. So we had just lots of players that were really good and came here to play, and they just did an awesome job. And then we had Brady Industries. Craig Bouchard had married Melissa Nelson, who was Julie's hitting partner when she was training there with you. And excuse me, Dennis, I've got a cough. I'm sorry. And
yeah, no problem.
Excuse me. Melissa Nelson and Julie had been hitting partners, and Melissa went on to her career and then married Craig Bouchard. But she followed Julie. So Craig knew about Julie when he got here after he selected Ashland to build the aluminum plant. He came to our house and met us and invited us to dinner. And he told us about this, about how Melissa had talked about Julie, and he wanted to meet her. So I thought, gosh, Craig was a really fanatical tennis fan. I mean, he's really a fan. He loves tennis, and his daughters were all really good national level players and everything. So I talked to Julie about it, and I said, we ought to get another professional tournament here. the last one we'd had was 2008, and this was in 2017. And she said, well, I'll introduce you to the guy you need to talk to. So I went to the U.S. Open with her, and she took me right to this guy and introduced me to him. I told him we wanted the tournament. He said, okay, so you get it. And so we got it just like that. And we put on another great event. It was the Kentucky Tennis of the Year, Tennis Tournament of the Year.
Right.
It was very well received.
How many years did you do it that second time?
Well, we just did two because we did the second one. We did, you know, 2018 and 2019. And then the pandemic hit the next year, you know, 2020.
Right.
The week that the pandemic hit the United States was January 20th. That week, Arlay and Belfont announced they were closing their doors. And Craig Bouchard lost his position as CEO of Brady Industries the same week. All this happened, the pandemic, Arlay Belfont, who was our second sponsor, and Brady Industries, who was our first sponsor. Between the two of them, they were $100,000 in sponsorship for that tournament.
God. Plus,
with the pandemic, we couldn't hold it anyway.
Yeah.
They canceled all the pro circuit tournaments.
Right.
And so we lost it completely, plus we lost our sponsorship. So we couldn't do it again. I was hoping to do that the rest of my life, every year.
Right. Well, I know one of the huge benefits of doing that tournament was the clinics that Julie was able to do, you know, all the exposure that you all got for tennis in the Ashland area, as well as you took a lot of that money and really fixed up the Ashland Tennis Center.
Oh yeah, we put $113,000 in resurfacing 10 courts, and the year before we put $27,000 in resurfacing 4 courts. So, a total of about $147,000, something like that, in 2 years into the tennis center. And then Julie was given free lessons in 2019. She was diagnosed with cancer in 2015, and then in 2000, and she was doing multiple, assistant coach at Middle Tennessee and assistant coach at U of L, assistant at Vanderbilt, and then at multiple clubs, including Idlewild and then Belfont and River Park. But she came back to Ashland. She got married to Josh Qualls and then adopted his little boy. So she was pretty busy doing that, but she was still giving private lessons. And she decided to give free lessons to any kids in Ashland from 6 to 18 years old for a month, three days during the week for 2 hours. It would have been 12 individual hours of lessons for each kid. And then she recruited 22 people to help her do it, who were like their college players, mostly whom she had coached in their career. And these were friends of hers. And there were a few high school kids that helped her with it and pulled that off. And it was amazing. She had 150 kids take free lessons for a month. And she had 150 to start the first day. She had 150 to finish the last day. I mean, it was, and their parents.
And I have
hundreds of parents.
Yeah. I have to feel like she learned her ability to organize and do all that stuff from you and Juanita from years ago. Jack, let's kind of finish this up here. And,
okay.
You know, I really have two questions for you. You know, the first one is, what has tennis meant in your life to you? And I mean, it's obvious your passion, it all comes across, but if you had to summarize it, what would you say?
Tennis was an extremely healthy recreational activity that includes competition. And it makes you want to be better because you want to do better. And so you train, you practice, and you, even people that are 75 years old that play tennis still want to be better. I still want to be better. I still practice so I can be better. And so it's a good way to maintain good health. You meet lots of people. It's a sociable sport where you get to meet people from all over the world. I've met so many people from all over the world playing tennis and bringing all these players into Ashland, these tournaments, for instance. It's you make friends for life. I've had so many good friends, and I just love to go out and hit with them or play with them or, you know, be in contact with them. And you're included in that. I've really appreciated your friendship all the years that you've been coaching UK, and you get to see a lot of success, and people go on and do well. All these kids that got scholarships to college and all that. I mean, that's just amazingly satisfying. And it's a good thing for our family. Our family got to play and do a lot of things together. We traveled a lot together and went a lot of places, and always tried to make them, you know, enjoyable things. We didn't just spend all the time at the tennis courts. We went to lots of places. We went to like zoos and movies and recreational places, and the kids got to see the country, and they got to go. All of our children have been to Europe and back several times because of tennis and because that's opened the doors to do that kind of thing. And
right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, second question that, you know, so a couple of years ago, and you're actually on the Hall of Fame committee, and you're kind of the guy that on that committee that is really good because, you know, you've been involved in so many different levels of the game, of the sport, you know, from having a daughter represent the United States and play Wimbledon to doing beginners clinics in Ashland, Kentucky, you know, that has its own little private center there. So you've been involved in all these things, but you get the call from John English and he says, Jack, we've decided to put you in the Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
Well, I consider that was recognition for Eastern Kentucky, which didn't have anybody in the Hall of Fame at that time. I felt like that everybody that had helped us do all these things here was really shared in that honor. I felt like this was just recognition for what we were doing in Eastern Kentucky for everybody that was involved. And I've tried to represent our area of the state in every way that I can. Back when we were doing tournaments where we encouraged people to, I got a rule passed in the state KTA meeting that in order to be ranked in the state, you had to play at least one ranking tournament outside of your city. And that was a hard thing to get passed, but I got it passed because I felt like the players out in the rest of the state needed to have the recognition. And if you go back and look at the state ranking years and years ago, 40 years ago, most of all the people that were ranked in the state in every single category were all from Louisville. But with that rule, all of a sudden people from out in the state got recognition. And I think it helped to broaden tennis for the whole state of Kentucky. So I was always thinking in terms of how to make things better for everybody else. And I consider that award just recognition for that. And I appreciate it very much.
Yeah. Jack, we just appreciate so much all you do for the state of Kentucky, all you continue to do, but certainly, you know, one of the true legends in Kentucky tennis history for the state of Kentucky. And thank you for taking this time to share your experiences with us on so many different levels.
Well, thank you. And I just will put in one little plug for the foundation that we created, the Julie Diddy Qualls.
Correct. Foundation. My fault. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say that foundation just received the federal tax exempt status yesterday, and so we're finally able to be, you know, a tax exempt status, and we're looking forward to doing things not only for our area here but for other parts of the state, and I'm going to continue to work to see that tennis can be a really viable opportunity for kids to do better in life and to have the experiences we've had for myself and for our family, and all of our children have appreciated that. So, and
what are you planning to do with the foundation when you say things that you're going, what is, I know tennis lessons in Ashland,
yeah,
you know, is a big part of it. I know, you know, that potentially you're looking at bringing a tournament there, maybe, you know, something, yeah, like that. But what would be your, what are you looking at with this foundation that honors Julie?
Well, we haven't really sat down with everybody on the board to give everybody an opportunity to have input to do that at this point. we've been just sort of gearing up for this one free lessons that we're going to be doing June 6th through June 17th down at the tennis center. But I want to have input from everybody in the board to see what thoughts they have on it, you know, and you're on our board, you know, Jeff McDonald's on the board, Todd Wise on the board, and Jerry Gross. I want to have, and several of our kids are on the board and things like that, but I want to have input from everybody to see ways that we can make a difference.
Great. Okay, Jack. Well, thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
One last thing, Dennis.
Yes, sir.
I couldn't have done this without my wife, Juanita, that I met on a blind tennis date. So as far as what tennis has meant to me, it's meant a marriage for 51 years. We met 54 years ago, and we have had a great life, and I appreciate everything. She's been a backer, a supporter, an activist, and a helper, and doubles partner, and mother, and wife, and grandmother. And I couldn't have had a better partner in life, and I couldn't have done any of this stuff without her help.
Well, I've been able to witness it, and I've got to say, I agree with you completely. She's wonderful.
Yep.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate it.